Chapter 3. The nightclub was typical of the places that white Russians have been operating all over Europe since the revolution of 1917. They all have the same waiters, who all used to be aristocrats, the same choirs all made up of former officers of the guard, the same high prices, and the same melancholy atmosphere. In addition, they all have the same dim lighting, and I was counting on that. Just as the waiter had said, there were Germans, and they were definitely not refugees. They were probably spies, members of the German legation, or employees of German firms.
"The Russians," said Schwartz, "have been more successful than we have in making a place for themselves. It's true they had a 15-year head start. 15 years of exile is a long time, a lifetime of experience."
"They were the first wave of refugees," I replied. "People were still sorry for them. They were given work permits and papers, Nansen passports. When we came, the world's supply of pity had long been used up. We were nuisances, termites. Hardly anyone had a good word for us. We have no right to work, no right to exist, and we still have no papers." I had been feeling nervous ever since we set foot in this place. It was probably a reaction to the closed-in, heavily curtained room, my awareness that there were Germans about, and the fact that I was sitting too far from the door for an easy getaway. I had long been in the habit of sitting near the exit, wherever I went. It also made me nervous that from here I couldn't see the ship. Maybe some message had come, and it would sail, ahead of time, that very night. Schwartz seemed to read my thoughts. He reached into his pocket and put the tickets down in front of me.
"Take them. I'm not a slave driver. Take them and go if you want to."
I was ashamed. "You've got me wrong," I said. "I have time, all the time in the world." Schwartz did not reply. He waited. I took the two booklets and put them in my pocket.
"I arranged to take a train," he went on, as though nothing had happened, "that would reach Osnabrück early in the evening. I felt that I was crossing the border only now. Up until then, the people and things, even in my native land, had been strangers to me. But now every tree began to speak. I knew the villages we rode through. As a schoolboy, I had gone there on excursions, or I had been there with Helen in the first weeks of our acquaintance. I had loved this countryside, as I had loved the city with its houses and gardens. Up until then, my horror had been abstract and all of a piece. What had happened had paralyzed me, turned me to stone. I had never felt the need to analyze it, to consider it in detail. Actually, I had been afraid to do so. Now, suddenly, the little things began to speak, things that had nothing to do with the horror, and yet were part of it. The countryside hadn't changed. It was still the same. The steeples still had the same soft green patina in the setting sun. The river still reflected the sky. It reminded me of the days when I had gone fishing and dreamed of adventures in strange lands. Well, I had had plenty of those, but they weren't exactly what I had imagined. The meadows with their butterflies and dragonflies hadn't changed, nor had the hillsides with their trees and wild flowers. They were exactly as in the days of my youth, and in them lay my youth, buried, if I wanted to look at it that way, or ready to be discovered, if I tried to be more optimistic. And there was nothing to mar the scene. From the train I saw few people and no uniforms, only the countryside, gradually sinking into the dusk. There were roses and dahlias and lilies in the tiny gardens of the station masters. They were just as they had always been. The leprosy hadn't corroded them. They grew on wooden trellises, just as they did in France, and in the meadows stood cows, just as in the meadows of Switzerland. Brown and black and white, without swastikas, with the same old patient eyes. I saw a stork clattering on a farmhouse, and the swallows flew as they fly everywhere and always. Only the people had changed. I knew it, but that evening I couldn't see it, and I couldn't understand it either. Besides, they were not as uniformly different as I had foolishly imagined. The compartment filled up and emptied and filled up again. At that time of day there were few uniforms. Nearly all the people were plain people, and their conversation was pretty much what I was accustomed to in France and Switzerland, about the weather, the harvest, the events of the day, and the fear of war. They, too, were afraid of war. The only difference was that outside of Germany everyone knew that Germany had wanted it, whereas here I heard that other countries were forcing it on Germany. Almost everyone was for peace, as people always are just before a war breaks out. The train stopped. I squeezed through the gate with the crowd. The inside of the station hadn't changed since I had last seen it. It only seemed smaller and dustier than I remembered. When I stepped out into the Bahnhofsplatz, everything I had been thinking fell away from me. Night was falling and the air was damp, as after rain. I no longer saw my surroundings. Everything trembled within me, and I knew that from then on I would be in great danger. At the same time, I had the feeling that nothing could happen to me. It was as though I were standing under a glass bell that protected me, but might shatter into bits at any moment. I went back in to the ticket window and bought a return ticket to Münster. I couldn't live in Osnabrück. It was too dangerous. "When is the last train?" I asked the ticket seller, who sat in the yellow light behind his window, his bald head glistening like a small-town Buddha, utterly secure and immune to all vicissitudes. "There's one at 9:20 and another at 11:12. I went to a slot machine and bought a platform ticket. I wanted to have it handy in case I had to disappear in a hurry before train time. As a rule, station platforms are poor hiding places, but usually you have several to choose from. 3 in Osnabrück. You can jump into a train that's about to leave, explain to the conductor that you've made a mistake, pay the difference, and get out at the next stop. I had decided to call up a friend of former years, whom I knew to be no supporter of the regime. His tone on the telephone would tell me whether he could help me. I was afraid to call my wife directly, because I didn't know whether she lived alone. I stood in the little glass booth with the telephone book in front of me. My heart beat so hard as I turned the soiled and rumpled corners of the pages that I thought I could hear it. I even thought others could hear it, and bent low to avoid being recognized. Unthinking, I had opened up to the letter with which my former name began. I found my wife's name. The phone number was the same, but the address had changed. Rismühleplatz was now called Hitlerplatz. The moment I saw the address, it seemed to me that the dismal light bulb in the booth grew 100 times stronger. I looked up, overcome by a feeling that it was black night outside and that I was standing in a brightly lighted glass box or in the beam of a searchlight. Once again, the madness of my undertaking struck me with full force. I left the phone booth and passed through the half-darkened station. The blue skies and happy faces of strength through joy posters looked down at me menacingly. A train or two must have arrived. A swarm of travelers was coming up the stairs. An SS man stepped out of the throng and headed in my direction. I didn't run. Maybe he had someone else in mind. but he stopped right in front of me and looked me full in the face. "Pardon me," he said. "Have you got a light?" "A light?" I repeated, and then quickly, "Yes, of course, a match." I reached into my pocket and searched. "Why a match?" said the SS man, surprised. "Your cigarette's burning." I hadn't even realized I was smoking. I held out my cigarette. He touched his to the incandescent tip and drew. "What's that you're smoking?" he asked. "Smells like a cigar." It was a Guluaza. I had bought a few packs before crossing the border. "A present from a friend," I said. "French. Black tobacco. He brought them back from France. They're too strong for me, too." The SS man laughed. "The best would be to stop smoking altogether, like the Führer. But it's not easy, especially in times like this." He saluted and left. Schwartz smiled feebly. When I was still a human being with the right to go where I pleased, I used to have my doubts about the way writers describe terror. The victim's heart stands still. He can't move a limb. Icy shivers run down his spine. His whole body breaks out in sweat. Clichés and clumsy writing, I thought. Maybe so. But it's also the truth. It's exactly how I felt, though in my days of innocence such things had made me laugh. A waiter approached. "Wouldn't you gentlemen like some company?" "No." He bent over me. "Before you say no, let me call your attention to the two ladies at the bar." I looked at them. One of them seemed very well built. Both had on close-fitting evening dresses. I couldn't make out their faces. "No," I said again. "They are ladies," said the waiter. "The one on the right is a German lady." "Did she send you?" "No, sir," the waiter replied with a disarmingly innocent smile. "It was my own idea." "Good, bury it. Bring us something to eat instead." "What did he want?" Schwartz asked. "To tie us up with Matahari's granddaughter. You must have given him too much tip." "I haven't paid yet." "You think they're spies?" "Possibly. But for the one real international in the world, Mammon."
"Germans?"
"One of them," the waiter said.
"Do you think she's been sent to lure Germans back home?"
"I doubt it. That's more in the Russian line nowadays." The waiter brought us a dish of canapés that I had ordered because the wine was going to my head. I was determined to keep my wits about me. "Aren't you going to eat?" I asked Schwartz. He shook his head absently.
"It had never occurred to me that those cigarettes might give me away," he said. "Now I checked through all my belongings. My matches were from France, too. I threw them away with the rest of my cigarettes and bought German. Then I remembered that my passport had a French entry stamp and visa. In case of questioning, I'd have had no difficulty in accounting for the French cigarettes. Bathed in sweat and furious with myself for my fears, I went back to the telephone booth. I had to wait. A woman with an enormous party badge called two numbers in succession and thundered commands. The third number didn't answer. The woman came out, self-important and furious. I called my friend's number. A woman's voice answered.
"May I speak to Dr. Martins, please?"
I noticed that my voice was hoarse.
"Who is speaking?" the woman asked.
"A friend of Dr. Martins." I couldn't give my name. The voice might be either his wife's or the maid's, but it would be a mistake to trust either of them.
"Your name, please," said the woman.
"I am a friend of Dr. Martin's," I answered. "Please tell him that, on urgent business."
"I'm sorry," the woman's voice answered. "If you won't tell me your name, I can't announce you."
"You'll have to make an exception," I said.
Dr. Martins is expecting my call. In that case, you can surely tell me your name. I racked my brains in desperation. Then I heard the receiver being hung up. I stood in the gray, windy station. My first move, which had seemed so simple, had gone wrong, and I had no idea what to do next. Maybe I'd have to call Helen directly and run the risk that a member of her family would recognize me by my voice. I could give a different name, but what name? Dr. Martins. I could think of no other at the moment. I hesitated, and then an idea dawned on me, so obvious that it would have come to me in a flash at the age of 10. Why not call Dr. Martins and give the name of my wife's brother? Martins knew him well and had taken an intense dislike to him 10 years back. The same woman's voice answered.
Georg Jürgen speaking, I said briskly. Dr. Martins, please.
Are you the gentleman who called up before?
This is Sturmbannführer Jürgens. I wish to speak to Dr. Martins immediately.
Certainly, said the woman. Just a moment. Schwartz looked at me.
Do you know that terrible soft buzzing in the receiver when you're waiting for your life on the telephone? I nodded.
It doesn't even have to be life that you're waiting for. It can be the void that you're trying to exercise.
Schwartz went on with his story. Dr. Martins speaking, I heard at last. Again, I was in one of those states that would once have made me laugh. My throat was parched.
Rudolf, I whispered finally.
I beg your pardon.
Rudolf, I said. This is a relative of Helen Jürgens.
I don't understand. Aren't you Sturmbannführer Jürgens?
I'm calling for him, Rudolf, for Helen Jürgens. Don't you understand now?
I don't understand a thing, said the voice on the phone with irritation. I'm in the middle of a consultation.
Couldn't I come to your office, Rudolf? Are you very busy?
What are you driving at? I don't even know you, and you...
Old Shatterhand, I said. Suddenly I had remembered the names we had called each other by as boys playing Indians, names from the novels of Carl May that we had devoured at the age of 12. For a moment I heard nothing. Then Martins said softly,
"What's that?"
"Winnetou," I answered.
"Have you forgotten the old names?"
"Why, those are the Führer's favorite books."
"That is true," he said.
"It was generally known that the man who was starting the Second World War had by his bedside the 30 or more volumes of Carl May's collected works, and that these books about Indians, trappers, and hunters, which strike any normal boy of 15 as at least slightly ridiculous, were his favorite reading matter."
"Winnetou?" Martins repeated in a tone of incredulity.
"Yes. I've got to see you."
"I don't understand. Where are you?"
"Here, in Osnabrück."
"Where can we meet?"
"I'm having consultations," said Martins mechanically.
"I'm sick. Can I come and consult with you?"
"What's the point in all this?" said Martins in a voice that showed he had decided what to do. "If you're sick, just come and see me. Why bother to phone?"
"When?"
"The best time would be 7:30. 7:30, he repeated. "Not before."
"Good. I'll see you at 7:30. I put down the phone. I was bathed in sweat. Slowly I made my way to the exit. A pale half-moon appeared for an instant between the clouds. In just a week, I thought, it will be the new moon. A good time to cross the border. I looked at the clock. I still had 3/4 of an hour's time. Better get away from the station. People who hang around stations always look suspicious. I took the street that was darkest and least frequented. It led to the old ramparts. One section had been leveled and topped with tall trees. Another, along the river, remained as it had been. I followed the ramparts, crossed a square, and passed the Church of the Sacred Heart. From the upper ramparts, you could look across the river at the roofs and towers of the city. The Baroque dome of the cathedral glistened in the wavering moonlight. I knew this view. It was reproduced on 1,000 postcards. I also knew the smell of the water and the smell of the linden trees on the avenue that skirted the ramparts. I saw lovers sitting on the benches that had been set up between the trees, offering a view of the river and the city. I sat down on an empty bench to kill the half hour before I could go to see Martin's. The bells of the cathedral began to ring. I was so agitated that the vibrations literally shook me. It was like observing an invisible game of tennis. One of the players was my old self I knew so well, who trembled and was afraid and didn't dare to reflect on his situation. The other was my new self, who was bold and risked his life as if there were no other possible course. A strange schizophrenic contest observed by a passive, objective arbiter who, for all his objectivity, hoped in his heart that the new self would win out. I remember that half hour in every detail. I even remember my amazement at taking such a clinical view of myself. It was as if I was standing in a room with facing mirrors. They cast my reflection back and forth in an infinity of empty space, and behind every reflection I discovered another, looking over the preceding one's shoulder. The mirrors seemed old and tarnished, and I couldn't make out whether the expression was questioning, sad, or hopeful. The images were blurred by the silvery darkness. A woman sat down beside me. I didn't know what she wanted, and I had no idea whether the barbarian regime had by now reduced even these things to military exercises. So I stood up and left. I heard the woman laughing behind me, and I've never forgotten the soft, rather contemptuous, commiserating laugh of that unknown woman on the Herrentischwall in Osnabrück.